I'm going to hit you with a couple of questions because in your postscript, you have a lot of information there that I want to ask you about.
All right.
And one thing that struck me, and if I can find the postscript, it must be at the end.
Yeah.
When I fly, when all of us fly, we fly over territory that has been used over and over again. The site of Indian trails, of battles, of housing developments, of shopping centers. Over and over, this land is used. And you, in effect, make reference to it because you were flying on a 747 out of Dulles, or maybe a landing. Can you tell me about that and what went through your mind as you looked below and you saw this countryside?
Yes, it was the first time that I had ever flown on a 747, which has no particular relevance except that it gave me a sense of grandeur. The thing was so big, you know. And as the plane took off from Dulles International Airport, which is outside of Washington, out in the Virginia countryside, it just came to me almost out of the blue that looking down, I could see almost the whole of the Eastern Theater of War during the Civil War, territory that the Northern armies and Southern armies struggled over for nearly 4 years, and which, of course, in those days, with no paved roads and very little other means of transportation, was a huge theater of war, you know, permitting great room for maneuver. Now you can drive from Washington to Richmond on the interstate in a couple of hours. So it just struck me at that time that I was seeing all this, and I was turning over in my mind anyway the possibility of writing a Civil War novel, and that more or less closed the idea in my mind. And on that flight to California, I started working on some notes for what became this novel.
Why have you been interested in the Civil War?
I suppose everyone who's brought up in the South, to some extent at least, is interested in that. You cut your teeth on it in a way. I can remember my grandmother telling stories about when Sherman came through. I can remember the last reunion of the old Confederate veterans when I was a very small boy. So it's something that you know about, that you feel strongly. And in my particular case, I've done a lot of reading about it over the years because I think it's a very fascinating episode. It's just something I've been interested in for years.
As a boy, you grew up in South Carolina, right?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. Did you harbor the traditional prejudices that many Southerners have for the North?
No, not particularly. I suppose it's more nearly the other way around. I probably harbored some particular prejudices about being Southern, you know, being proud of that and so forth. But I don't ever remember having any animosities particularly towards anyone. By the time I was growing up, I mean, the war was far enough in the background, I suppose 3/4 of a century. I was born in 1926, I really didn't think of it in terms of animosity, but I was interested in it, and I always sought out every opportunity to go to the old battlefields and so forth.
Tom Wicker, why did you decide to select this one particular battle, the Second Battle of Manassas, as the site of your Civil War novel?
Well, because I particularly remembered from reading many years ago the account of that battle, and particularly the march of Jackson's army, which is one of the great marches in history around Pope's army, into his rear. I particularly remember reading about that in Douglas Southall Freeman's great book, Lee's Lieutenants. Stuck in my head as a dramatic story. Then, years later, when I was living and working in Washington for the New York Times, I bought a little piece of worn-out property in Virginia to have a weekend place, and I discovered not far from that a historical marker on an old backcountry road that said Jackson's army had passed that point on the march to the Battle of Second Manassas. And that stimulated my imagination, and I began thinking about it more so that within the year when I began active planning for a Civil War novel, it was just natural to choose that particular battle as the centerpiece for it. And besides, the Manassas battlefield, both First Manassas and Second, was between my property and Washington. You can drive out from Washington to that area now in an hour, so that I could easily walk the battlefield and that sort of thing.
In a nutshell, can you give my listeners an idea of what this battle was all about?
Yes, it was really in the first full summer of battle. McClellan's Federal Army had menaced Richmond by coming up the peninsula, and in the battles of the 7 days, so-called, Robert E. Lee's Confederate armies relieved the siege of Richmond by McClellan. They defeated McClellan in the 7 days' battles. Another Federal army was coming overland, however, towards Richmond, and Lee's army was badly outnumbered, so he decided to attack the Second Federal Army before it could be joined by McClellan's retreating army. And the attack on that second Federal Army under General Pope was the Battle of Second Manassas, about which I've written this long book.
Why was that battle important in the Civil War?
Well, it was particularly important as you look back on it because it was the prelude to the first Confederate invasion of the North. After the Second Battle of Bull Run, the Federal armies were in great disarray. They retreated into Washington, and Lee seized the opportunity, crossed the Potomac, and invaded Maryland in an effort to detach Maryland from the Union and bring it into the Confederacy and perhaps end the war with one stroke. On the other side, President Lincoln was looking for a military victory to give him the right opportunity to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. The battle at Manassas, Second Bull Run, did not give him that opportunity, but when Lee invaded Maryland, he reappointed McClellan head of the Federal armies, and the Confederate invasion was turned back at the battle that's known primarily as Antietam, to some in the South is known as Sharpsburg, a little town of Sharpsburg, Maryland. And after that battle, then Lincoln did issue the Emancipation Proclamation, which I think turned the course of the war for good. Therefore, there's a certain sense in which you can look at the Second Battle of Bull Run, Second Manassas, as having been the high point of the whole short history of the Confederacy, and I do think that's true.
What do you think would have happened had the North scored a substantial victory at the Second Battle of Manassas?
Well, that simply would have hastened the end of the Confederacy, because presumably, if that had happened, Lee's army would have been very badly hurt. He had divided his army in order to surround Pope, so to speak. And so one wing or the other very probably would have been destroyed, which would have been disastrous for the South. Lincoln would have issued the Emancipation Proclamation that much sooner. There never would have been an invasion of the North. I suspect if that had happened, the war would have been substantially shortened by as much as a year, or maybe even 2 years.
Now, Tom Wicker, in unto this hour, you've given us a variety of characters, many of whom are quite vivid. Many are real, and many are products of your imagination. How does the reader know where one stops and the other picks up?
Well, in any case where I think there's a serious problem of the historical distortion or confusion, well, I've explained in a postscript to the book about that. But I don't think there are many such instances. Most of the characters in here who are like characters in a book and fully developed as to the, or as, insofar as I could, are fictional characters. And persons whose names would be recognizable from history, Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, General Pope, General McClellan, President Lincoln. I make no effort to develop them in a novelist sense as characters. They are simply presences in the novel. And just as, let us say, President Reagan is a presence in our life, is a presence in our lives today. And I try, and I think I have succeeded to about 95%, not to have any of these historical presences, like General Lee, let's say, do or say anything that I don't know as a matter of historical fact that they did do and say. And so they move through the book in a way, just like, as I say, like presences, but they're not. There's no effort here to develop them as characters in a fictional sense.
Why did you select the novel form rather than nonfiction?
Well, I sometimes wondered that myself when I got into it. I like to think of myself as a novelist. This is my 8th novel. I like fiction. I think there's a great deal more that one can do in fiction, if it's successful, than in nonfiction. And it's true. I could have written, I think, a very interesting historical account of the summer of 1862. It's a very dramatic 3 or 4 months of action in the Civil War, and it would have made a nice self-contained nonfiction book. But I didn't want to do that. I wanted to write a novel, and I wanted to write a historical novel. And this was also a rather handy, self-contained drama around which one could build a novel, or so it seemed to me.
Isn't it interesting that most people, most readers, get a glimpse of history not through nonfiction, but through historical novels, or through novels of any kind? For example, Dickens gave us a great glimpse of life in the 19th century. At the turn of the century, there was Frank Norris and The Octopus and Upton Sinclair and these writers who let us know about working conditions. And so we have vivid images of our past, but in a fictional form.
That's quite true. And the greatest novel of all, War and Peace, is in fact a historical novel. Tolstoy was looking back a half century at the Napoleonic invasion of Russia. And no, I think historical fiction, in the sense you mean it, is a very valuable part of our literature. There is another genre, of course, historical romances, which is somewhat different. But even there, as long as they're done with some care, why they're useful books. It's interesting about our American Civil War, however, that there has not been a great deal of serious fiction, one would say, about it. I think the reason for that is that the participants in that war, operating in the 19th century as they were, they left absolutely copious literature of memoirs, diaries, letters to their families, unit histories, accounts of this army or that general and so forth. But the nonfiction history of the Civil War is extensive. It's copious. It's an enormous and fascinating literature. But there's not much fiction, and I think probably the reason is that those who knew that war at first hand exhausted their literary impulse in memoirs and diaries and letters and so forth.
Well, even Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage was certainly a post-Civil War.
That's right.
Novel.
He was not a participant in the war. The only distinguished piece of fiction that I know of that was written by a participant in the Civil War is called The Conversion of Miss Ravenel from Secession to Union. And that is not only a distinguished novel about the Civil War, but it's one of the more distinguished American novels of the 19th century. Not very well known, but a very good book.
Well, you brought me to my next question, and that is the research that you did. You mentioned there is copious material on the Civil War. So where did you get this? What did you use, and where did you work?
Well, as an amateur in history, I started with the secondary sources, Douglas Southall Freeman's biography of Robert E. Lee, and books about Stonewall Jackson. And in any book of that kind, if it's well done, there's an extensive bibliography. And the bibliography begins to go to primary sources, to letters and diaries and memoirs and so forth. And I quite eagerly cannibalized those and began to compile a long list of documents and that I wanted to pursue. And I went to the Manassas battlefields are now a national park, as you know. There's a center there, and they had a good bit of documentary material that I was able to use, maps and so forth. So, and the farther you get into it, one thing leads to another. Let us say you're reading some person's account of a unit, a Confederate regiment, let's say, and there'll be a note in there or a footnote or a bibliography or something that'll lead you to another. And so, in the long run, it becomes fascinating. And fortunately, I would say here that the American History Collection of the New York City Public Library is one of the great assets that anyone embarking on a project like this could have. I really think that it's, I did a great deal of my research there, and I'm very grateful for that collection.
Did you do your writing here in New York?
I did it here and at my house in Vermont, yes.
Mm-hmm. This was quite a project for you. How long did it take you?
Well, I worked on it, the actual writing, I worked on it over a period of 4 years. But that doesn't mean I worked on it every day that way. In fact, sometimes months would go by and I wouldn't really have any time to get to it. But over a period of about 4 years for the actual writing, if I count from the time I first started thinking about this book and began to point my reading in Civil War literature towards this particular book, it's nearer 10 years.
It's a marvelous achievement.
Thank you.
Let me ask you this. The area around the battlefield, Manassas, how has that changed? You mentioned it was a battleground that's been preserved to a degree, but in the surrounding area, what are there, shopping centers and housing projects?
No, there's nothing like that. The only thing of that kind that has interfered at all is now a cemetery. It's called the Stonewall Memorial Gardens, I believe, right on the ground where the climactic part of the battle took place on August the 30th, 1862. But a cemetery, in many ways, is quite appropriate for this blood-soaked ground. The main change is that in 1862, the area around Manassas was very heavily farmed, and all of that was farmland at that time. Although there remained patches of woods and forests and so forth. Since then, that area is not so heavily farmed as it once was. After all, that's a part of Virginia that's been settled since back in the 16th century. And so that land is worked out in many ways. Therefore, since it's not as heavily farmed as it once was, what once were, in some cases, cleared fields are now grown up in secondary growth, pine thickets, and that sort of thing. So that the ground doesn't look quite as it once did, but the salient features of it are still there. Anyone who reads my book will learn that the Stonewall Jackson's army sheltered itself in an old unfinished railway line. It was unfinished even at that time in 1862. And it was... embankments and cuts through the hills there to make it a level railway line. It made an ideal defensive line. And you can go to the scene today, and that line is still there. I mean, you can walk right through it. It's about a mile long. And Jackson put 18,000 men in that line. And their historical markers there. It's a very interesting thing to do. And you can figure out by pacing it off about where each unit was and so forth. And the salient feature of that railway line is called the Deep Cut, where an enormous struggle took place literally hand-to-hand. The Union charge overwhelmed the Confederates at that point, and they fought literally hand-to-hand with rocks, bayonets, anything. And the Deep Cut, which is marked by a marker that was put up right after the war, the Civil War, is there, and you can see why they call it the Deep Cut. And you can, it's, if you have an imagination even remotely active, you can actually feel and hear that battle going on again, because the ground simply isn't changed. It's as it was.
As an amateur historian, would you put on your thinking cap and just speculate for me, what would have happened to this country had the South won the war?
Well, I suspect that that it would have been a temporary division, because I believe that it would, the very traditions and energy of this country, even by then, by the middle of the 19th century, I think ultimately would have brought the two halves of the country together again. But it would have taken time, a half century, maybe more. By now, I believe the whole westward movement would have brought us together, because as it happens anyway, if you read the history of the western movement in this country, you know that the southern half of the West developed out of the South, and the northern half developed out of the North. So both sides are moving west, and I think that ultimately would have reunified the country. But there's no question that had the South won, this continent would have been divided for a much longer time. It's just almost impossible to predict what might have happened in that case. So one doesn't know what, for example, the British or the French might have done in terms of recognition, in terms of hostility towards one half or the other. It's in the long perspective of history, it's a very good thing that the war came out as it did, and that is even quite aside from the question of slavery, which, of course, was abolished by the Northern victory, properly so, naturally.
Wicker, my last question, it's a philosophical one, and maybe difficult to answer, and so if you can't answer it, don't. You have done much research and thinking about not only this battle, but obviously about the war, and you are indeed a Southerner. What lessons did the American people learn from the Civil War?
Well, a lot of that is difficult to know. Of course, we had the long legacy of segregation in the South. We had the long dominance of the Republican Party in this country, all of which grew out of the Civil War. Development of the Democratic Party prior to Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal was a product of the Civil War. I have my own view, which I don't know that I can prove historically, but I think that to some extent our tendency, quite evident in the Reagan administration, to try to settle political matters by the use or the threat of force derives from the Civil War to some extent. After all, the battle over union, the question of union or disunion, linked to the question of slavery, was probably the single most serious political issue that we ever had in this country. We like to pride ourselves on our democratic and republican forms of government. But the fact of the matter is, the most serious political issue that ever arose in this country was settled ultimately by force, by war. And I think that in our American psyche, so to speak, there is a tendency to think that really serious and divisive political issues, for example, our conflict now, the superpower conflict with the Soviet Union, that ultimately such issues as that must be settled by force. And I think we tend to move towards the use of the threat of force perhaps more quickly than is good for us or good for anyone, because of this deep historical experience.
Well, my postscript to that comment comes from Stephen Wright, who wrote a marvelous book called Meditations in Green, which is about his experience in Vietnam. But his belief that the Reagan administration's decision to invade Grenada was to get even for the United States' loss in Vietnam.
Well, it may well have been, and it's still not exactly established what the timing of that decision was, but I think it had also something to do with the fact that just 2 days before, our Marines had been blown up in Beirut by that car bomb. It is certainly true that the invasion of Grenada tended to take the sting out of that terrible shock to Americans.
Well, we're going off on tangents, so I want to thank you very much for coming in. I enjoyed talking to you. I certainly enjoyed the book.